From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Sears and Kmart struggle to stay alive.
These legacy companies just didn't keep up with what was happening in the marketplace.
It's the 20th anniversary of the famous brawl in Hockeytown, avenging a dirty hit by Claude Lemieux that smashed Chris Draper's face. We'll talk with Chris Draper.
People would talk about, you know, where they were when the game happened. It's just something that hockey fans don't forget.
And as the Wings prepare to leave Joe Louis Arena, how should Detroit honor Joe Louis once the arena is gone?
There was just this great sense of what it meant to be a champion. This is a city of champions, and if we don't honor their names, we'll forget their names.
And fighting to overcome the stigma of mental illness.
People are not seeking treatment early enough, and they're not getting the support they need, and they're not even talking to their friends and family who could help them get that support.
But first, the news. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The U.S. Census Bureau released new population estimates for 2016 today. These numbers look at births, deaths, and migration at the county level. Kurt Metzger is a demographer and the director emeritus of Data Driven Detroit and the mayor of Pleasant Ridge in Oakland County. Kurt, give us the top five counties in terms of population growth.
Top counties in terms of growth were Kent, Ouachita, Oakland, Macomb, and Ingham.
And then the flip side, which are the top five in population declines?
Flip side, people can probably guess the first two, Wayne and Genesee, followed by Jackson, Saginaw, and Marquette.
So let's talk about themes. What do you think the five winners, in the top five list, what are they doing right?
Well, what they're doing right is, first of all, they have pretty strong economies based in the counties. And, you know, when you're looking at counties like Kent, obviously we've seen tremendous growth in the medical sector, certainly the university, Grand Valley State, and that downtown redevelopment. And now Grand Rapids area is so much talk about it being a cool city, plus the fact that it's a very vibrant economy and that whole west side has gotten a lot of good press of late. So that's certainly driving them. Same thing with Washtenaw County in terms of the university, Ann Arbor, the university medical complex, and everything is growing. And Oakland, Macomb, and Ingham also have pretty strong economies. They have a lot of areas still of growth, a lot of townships, a lot of open land still, and suburban sprawl is alive and well. Oakland County also has a lot of small downtowns that are attracting a lot of people as well.
So looking at the counties that have the largest population losses, I guess we look at the kind of the inverse of that equation.
It is. I mean, we talk about, obviously, Detroit coming back, but Detroit is just on the, you know, the beginning of coming back, and it hasn't seen that large influx of growth. We haven't seen a lot of new housing. It's just coming on. And, yes, these are the older, you know, the older manufacturing, the older real urban areas that just don't seem to be generating a lot of population growth. And what's happening is Michigan is not seeing births going up. Michigan continues to see births going down. And so when we talk about natural increase, births over deaths, in most of Michigan and most of these areas, births are staying very stable. Things are changing in terms of deaths. Some of the older areas are seeing deaths increase. So that growth by natural increase is dropping. And really what's determining more than anything else, we talk about it at the state level and we talk about it at all the smaller levels of geography, is are we managing to retain residents, and can we attract residents from other parts of the country?
Because that's the sign of a vibrant economy.
That's it. I mean, that's where the rubber hits the road. And so a lot of these counties, I mean, for instance, Macomb and Oakland are getting a lot of influx from Wayne. Wayne County people move in to those areas. It's not necessarily that we're drawing a lot of people from out of state. Kent probably a little bit more, maybe be getting some of that Cook County, because Cook County was the biggest loser in the country. But it's basically people coming from other parts of the state of Michigan moving into these counties.
And knowing that Wayne County, you know, is second in the nation with the largest population decline for the second year in a row, they lost nearly 7,700 people last year. What do you worry about as you hear this trend?
Well, for Wayne, I was surprised. I thought for 2 years in a row they had seen that out-migration kind of decrease. And all of a sudden we've seen an increase. What I had made this grandiose prediction that before Duggan's first term would end, Detroit would see their first population gain since the early 50s. Now I'm starting to question that because, you know, if Wayne County is going to see that kind of population loss, it can't be from the rest of the county and Detroit gaining. it was the smallest loss of the decade overall. And so there is some hope that that's starting to stabilize. I understand that people in Wayne County say that, you know, the economy starts first and we're going to start to see some of that growth. I think we're going to see Detroit driving a good part of that county growth, but we still have a number of communities around Detroit. Even if Detroit starts to gain population, you still have the River Rouges and Inksters and E-Courses and Allen Parks, a lot of areas that are still seeing population loss.
And I know we'll see the population estimates for the cities and townships and villages coming up later in the year, so I'm sure we'll be talking with you about that.
I certainly hope so.
Kurt Metzger, Director Emeritus of Data Driven Detroit. Thank you so much, Kurt.
Thanks so much, Cindy.
They used to be a shopper's first choice. These days, Sears and Kmart are in a struggle to keep the doors open. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us. And Daniel, I grew up in Metro Detroit. Sears and Kmart, those were the first places my folks went for clothing or toys or my dad's tools or stuff for the house, stuff for the car. And now?
Nowadays, they're fast moving to extinction, I think. I had the same experience. I mean, my father, who was a big tool guy on the weekends and everything, always lectured me, get your hand tools at Sears, the Craftsman brand. That's what you need. And I do have Craftsman tools in my basement and to this day. But 20 years ago, I remember covering Kmart here in Troy when they were trying to be relevant and they were trying to fight back against Target and Walmart. 20 years ago, I mean, and this has just continued and continued this downward spiral. And now it's accelerating thanks to you and me and everybody else who orders their whatever they need on the internet.
It is an internal battle for consumers. I mean, you don't want that longtime store that you probably shopped at with your parents to go away. But it is really tough to beat the convenience of sitting there in your pajamas, making a few clicks in the boxes on your front porch. So is there a balance? What was missing? What didn't happen as these retailers were trying to cope with these new changes?
I think you have a couple of things. One is a lot of these stores tended to be in older suburbs and locations that people kind of left behind. I think that's one thing. Another thing is these legacy companies just didn't keep up with what was happening in the marketplace. And they were essentially, you know, fighting the last retail war, and retail was changing and shifting underneath them, and they were not able to scramble. And I think you see this a lot in industries where there are companies that can reinvent themselves. And despite all the problems that the Detroit automakers have had, they have been around for 100 years, and they are moving into a whole new phase of mobility and autonomous vehicles and electrification, the stuff we've talked about. So you can do it. But I think with retailers, the barriers to entry are a lot lower, and people can get in the game. And when you have someone like Amazon who has an approach to selling that they bring to the marketplace, and it's scalable, and they can just carry all sorts of things, more and more people will say, you know what, I can buy it on Amazon, or I have a contractor friend who every time you talk about anything, you know what he says? I say, where do I get that? He says, oh, just go on Amazon.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it'll be at your house in two. I mean, he doesn't even think about it. He says, you know, you can buy that on Amazon, which sometimes is true. I found that, and sometimes it's not true. But, you know, I think people are getting to the point where they're going to have to make choices. I've long believed that, you know, economic behavior has consequences. And if you lived in Michigan, for example, and you decided you were going to go out and buy your Honda, or you're going to buy your Toyota, you've made a choice. And that has an implication and an impact on the companies that live and operate in your community and employ your neighbors and friends. And I think it's the same thing with, you know, your general e-commerce. You know, do you decide you want to support the local guy? You want to go out and buy something that maybe you could order online, but you say, you know what, this guy's in my community, I want to support him. I try to do that sometimes, and I think other people do, but I don't know to what extent the vast majority of us do that.
And as you think of, you know, the bad news with Sears and Kmart, and tell us exactly what is that dire news? There's been kind of a new blast of trouble.
Yeah, well, they said in a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission that there was some real concern that they would not survive, that they would not remain, as it's called, a going concern. And the CFO came onto a company blog earlier this week and said, well, it's not quite that bad, and we've gotten a certification from our accountant that we should be able to operate as we need to operate through the year. But I think the feeling on the street, I mean, the stock dropped 12% in one day. There are people that are saying, you know, this is kind of the end of Sears as we know it. And if they go into bankruptcy, I think a lot of people think that one thing that will not come out of bankruptcy probably is Kmart. So we could be seeing the end of Kmart, which, interestingly enough, was started here in Metro Detroit in Garden City in 1962 by what was then the S.S. Kresge Company, or corporation, that had been around since the late 19th century.
And then add to that Macy's closing stores, JCPenney closing stores, and for the communities, as you say, where these stores are located, lost jobs, lost tax revenue.
Yeah, and the other thing, and not only that, but some of these, think about these malls. These stores, like a Macy's, they are anchors. These things are huge. So what are you going to do in a community with that building, right? Mm-hmm. And so it puts a lot of pressure on the local economic development officials, on the city councils and town councils, and on mayors to figure out what they're going to do. There have been some reports this week about an artist rendering of what they might do with Northland Mall in Southfield and how they might take the old Macy's building and make it into a mixed-use residential kind of deal. Mm-hmm. So essentially it would be condos on top of small shop retail with a parking deck and everything and using that whole big hulk. Well, that's a great idea if they can pull it off. But that's happening all around Metro Detroit with all these Macy's stores that have now closed. It's a real challenge.
And when you think of cost-cutting and closing stores and belt-tightening, we watched that happen in Kmart, and it completely transformed the stores from the lively places they used to be and then what a lot of us have seen as we've gone into these stores recently.
Yeah, if we go into them. I think that's the other thing. I mean, they're just – a lot of retail, I find, can be – particularly big box retail can be very depressing when you go into it, particularly the chains like we're talking about that have clearly seen a better day. When you think about Sears, I mean, when you and I were growing up, we can still remember the Sears catalog, right?
Oh, the Sears catalog was huge. And it's surprising, and you point out in your column today, Daniel, that Sears really seemed to have the ingredients that could or should have stood the test of time with the brands like Craftsman and Kenmore, and that Sears catalog was a fixture in our homes.
Yeah, and so why don't they make the jump, you ask yourself. Yeah. And I don't know the answer to that, but the reality is that when they did, they didn't do it fast enough and they didn't do it soon enough. And this is where you have innovators who can come in and say, you know what, Sears is going to be, somebody said this, but I wouldn't be surprised. Sears is going to be too slow and they're not going to be able to get out of their own way. And we've got an idea and we're going to beat them to the punch. And that's essentially what's happened.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Now to Minding, Michigan, as we focus on mental health questions in our state. A terrible personal tragedy can open your eyes to things that, up till then, had been out of sight, out of mind. For Abby Dart, it was her husband's suicide in 2004. That opened her eyes to the stigma that we've built up around mental health problems. Abby believes that stigma killed her husband, Steve. And she feels we can and must tear down that mental health stigma. Abby Dart, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
You had a very clear message in your recent Detroit News editorial, and that is that we need one unified system that looks at public health and mental health. How did we get to where we are with two separate systems?
You know, I think what had happened was many, many years ago, I call it sort of the dark ages. People were very frightened of anything dealing with the brain and mental health and mental illness. And my sense is that when we established many years ago a separate code, we had hospitals, people were chained to their beds, and it was never considered public health. It was the brain, and it was scary. And then you had health issues of the body, and they were separate. And I believe that's how it got started.
And then how do you think that built up that stigma that is something that keeps so many people from seeking the help they need?
I think part of it is fear. People don't understand that any illness of the brain today is treatable. Early intervention is key. And it's not something people want to talk about. I mean, you might talk about the fact that you have diabetes.
Or
you
might have a heart attack.
Or cancer. I think it's only slightly better. What's interesting is I'm originally from California. And, you know, so there's sort of a joke in California. Everybody's talking about what therapists they have. And it's common there. There's not the stigma. But when I moved to the Midwest, I think people have a very different reaction. And we need to tear down that wall.
And when you think of the difficulty that we as a society have seeing mental health issues as the same as physical problems, what kinds of problems has that led to, in your view?
Oh, many. For example, in my husband's case, when I say to people, I believe the stigma killed him and not the disease. And the reason is he was successful, Harvard-educated attorney. And even with all that education, he was reluctant to seek treatment early. He thought maybe a colleague or his employer might find out about it. And this happens to many people. Whether you went to Harvard or, you know, whatever your background is, you are ashamed. You're embarrassed. I'll give you another example. I was in the car the other day, and I heard an advertisement for online talk therapy. And what the voiceover said was, here's a way to seek therapy without the embarrassment of going to a therapist and in complete privacy. This is 2017. So this is the kind of thing I'm talking about. People are not seeking treatment early enough, and they're not getting the support they need, and they're not even talking to their friends and family who could help them get that support.
When your husband was dealing with whatever was happening in his mind, and as you say, there was a brain illness, but it was the stigma that killed him, did he look for help? How long did it go? What was going on?
Well, he I would say it started, let's say, in January of that year, and he was having some difficulties with depression, with sleeping. I really couldn't get him to see a doctor for a few months, and by then it was just a general practitioner. There was still this stigma is, you know, oh, I don't really want to see a psychiatrist. I can handle this. People think they can handle it. Well, you wouldn't think you could handle heart disease or high blood pressure. So it took a while, and at the end, he was hospitalized. And this is another issue, too. Under Michigan law and the way we handle people who go in voluntarily and want to leave voluntarily, if you're in a suicidal state and you're hospitalized but you aren't committed, you can walk out. You can leave. You would never do that for somebody that was hospitalized with a heart attack. Would they even think? Would their family members say, oh, you can just leave now and go home? So that's a whole other piece of the legal puzzle that needs to be dealt with.
And I know that you've been in touch. You reach out. You've been very active reaching out to policymakers and legislators.
Right.
What's the ask? What are you asking?
Well, initially, I thought it would be an easy ask. I thought if we could just put the mental health code, combine it with the public health code in Michigan, as they do federally. If you go to the Health and Human Services Department, if you look at the law, they have substance abuse and mental health under health and human services. So I thought, well, we won't have to change any laws. Everybody gets scared, nervous about that. But we could make a big public statement in Michigan saying, we understand that diseases of the brain are health, and let's not separate them anymore. And I met with a legislator, and there was some research done. And apparently, in order to do that, you have to do a couple of things. First, you have to open up both codes, and then you might get some amendments that wouldn't be good. And the other issue was apparently it might have been, you know, 20,000 bills, because every time you refer to something, you have to deal with that in another bill. It didn't look feasible. That doesn't mean I'm not going to still try and figure out other ways we can deal with the stigma, but we need to.
What was, if you look back to those months before your husband's suicide, what did you miss or what did you learn from that you could share with families now? What lessons can you share?
I think that if you have a family member that you're worried about, particularly if you're on your own, perhaps you're isolated, you don't have family nearby, it's you and your child or you and your spouse, you really have to encourage other family members to help you. If that means traveling across the country to be with you, don't take no for an answer. I don't put any blame at all on people around me at the time, because it's a very difficult situation. I had 5 children at the time. You know, you're trying to struggle with it all. But I would say pull in your family, even if they're uncomfortable with it. You know, beg them for help.
And it can happen at home, it can happen in neighborhoods, it can happen in schools. So it's something that can happen on a very granular level, can't it?
Well, what I also want to say is, and I know there is a lot of support for this by organizations, I think schools are a really good place to capture early onset illnesses that deal with the brain. And these children spend so much time in school. Here's another thing. We have, over the years, required students to have hearing exams and eye exams, sports physicals. My sense is that issues related to mental health and the brain are equally significant. And since suicide is the second leading cause of death for children between the ages of 10 and 24, we have an epidemic in this country. And perhaps parents are uncomfortable with that, but I'm sure they'd much rather see early intervention than to find that their child has died by suicide.
What's at stake if we don't wrap our arms around this problem that you described?
Well, what's at stake is we're going to see thousands of more death by suicide. We're going to see hundreds of people in Michigan, in our big cities in Detroit, end up in the legal system because, as opposed to being in the public health system, because untreated mental health issues often lead people to end up homeless or engage in criminal activity because they could have been treated and they're not. So they end up in the courts and our legal system instead of in our public health care system. And also, I'm very worried about the epidemic of suicide among our teenagers and our young people. And we really need to have opportunities for early intervention and talk about it.
Abby Dart, it was great to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Great to talk with you. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Collaborative.
Experimentation.
The next idea.
We need a participation revolution, and we need it fast.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Closing a school can be such a body blow to a neighborhood. We've seen it play out time and time again, especially in high poverty areas. A school closes, kids get shuffled around to some other school, and the neighborhood is left with a vacant building. Property values go down, crime often goes up, and families move out. Chris Lambert and his group, Life Remodeled, are determined that's not going to happen in one Detroit neighborhood. What they're going to do to the soon-to-be-moved Durfee Elementary and Middle School could be a template that could be used all through Michigan, especially as the state considers whether or not to shut down 38 struggling schools. Chris Lambert, good to have you back with us.
Great to be back on the radio with you.
Detroit Public Schools shut down 195 schools in under 15 years. Boy, and you drive around some of those neighborhoods, you really see a lot of emptiness, don't you?
Yes, and as you said earlier, so goes a school, so goes a neighborhood. We've seen it time in and time out, and that's why we're so focused on remodeling schools and providing better educational opportunities for kids.
And you've put a lot of money, Life Remodeled has, and money and effort into fixing up schools, some of which are now in danger of being closed. But you do a project a year, and I want to dig into this year's project, Durfee Elementary Middle School. What's happening there?
We are going to renovate that 90-year-old school building and turn it into what we're calling a community innovation center. And so the vision for this innovation center actually originally started with the principal of Central High School, which is the building right next to Durfee. And Central used to have about 4,000 students. Now they only have 366 enrolled in the school. So it's the first high school in Detroit, very rich history. And the building had about a $30 million makeover in 2006. So the principal originally wanted us to build the Community Innovation Center there at Central, but Detroit Public Schools Community District had a more innovative idea that they wanted to move all the kids from Durfee to Central, since Central has a better building and it's way under capacity. And they wanted us to build this Community Innovation Center over at Durfee.
So these elementary and middle school students at Durfee are basically moving next door to Central High School. So they're going to have a right from the littlest all the way to the end of high school in that building, right?
They're going to run a K through 12, and they're going to have various entrances and different floors for the kids so that it's a safe environment. But there are definitely a lot of positives to it.
And so here's this Durfee building that will become a community innovation center. What kind of innovation do you mean?
Well, there's really three core values that are driving our project right now, because Life Remodeled, what we're doing is we're leasing the space, we're building it out, but we're not going to run any programming in the space. And so we're recruiting tenants who believe in these three core values. Number one is entrepreneurism, second is education, and the third would be community. So when we talk about entrepreneurism as it relates to the Community Innovation Center, we want to bring in tenants who are going to be able to provide resources for aspiring entrepreneurs so that entrepreneurs can get access to not only office space, space, but free legal, marketing, accounting, access to capital, and then they can go launch their businesses in the local community and throughout Detroit. And then we want all our tenants to make a commitment to education so that they're pouring into the next generation, K through 12, right next door, but also to offer opportunities for the rest of Detroit public schools. And then, of course, we're looking for tenants who are going to be committed to community and building that camaraderie in the building and also engaging the community outside the building. So we're looking at potential programs like Junior Achievements BizTown, which is basically a 10,000-square-foot miniature city where fourth graders through sixth graders will come to this location. They'll learn how to run a company. They'll elect a mayor. They'll get paid money, like Monopoly money. They'll spend money, and they'll even get parking tickets if they're standing in the hallway too long. And that's just one of multiple types of programs and organizations that we're going to bring into this building. And one of our potential tenants is called the Empowerment Plan. That's an organization that actually makes coats that turn into sleeping bags for the homeless. But what really makes the story great is they hire women from homeless shelters and get them sustainable wages and into sustainable housing in the process. So we're going to be finding out exactly when our tenants are going to lock in their commitment, and then we'll build a suit.
So what I'm hearing is this isn't just activities and innovation aimed at youngsters. You're looking at a broad section of the community.
Yes. Primarily, it's going to be for kids, grades K through 12. For instance, there's a Tormina's Pizza that's going to give their license to their franchise for free to a Detroit owner who will in turn train Central High School students how to run that pizza shop. But we definitely want to have programming and opportunities for adults as well. And that's really where the entrepreneurism comes in. And there will be a recreation center, a coffee shop, a marketplace on the weekends. So we want it to be a one-stop shop that brings the generations together. But the main focus is kids and education.
For other areas and towns that could be facing schools that are going to be closed, what could a project like this mean in terms of keeping a neighborhood from being weakened by having a big, empty, unused school and grounds just sitting there?
Well, it's all about collaboration. And the way we're able to do what we do is through partnerships. You know, we're not an organization that tries to do everything. We really just try to stay in our lane. And what we're good at is finding out what are the needs and then who can help meet those needs. So we're basically a bridge that brings together a variety of organizations and all different kinds of industries, whether it's the corporate world, faith-based world, nonprofit, government. And I think that that position is just essential in any city or any town in Michigan, that somebody's playing that coordinator role. And also what we do is we organize the projects so that each entity can plug and play and not have to worry about red tape or it being slowed down or hindered by miscommunication. So streamlining those processes makes for a successful project.
You also, I know from talking with you about the work you do with Life Remodeled, these projects really are determined by the community's needs and what the community says it wants to see have happen there.
Correct. And this particular project is really a unique one because this one came straight from Detroit Public Schools Community District, and this is what they've asked for. And so we're delivering primarily for DPSCD and for the kids. And then we're adding on the community benefit as just a part of that's just who we are and that's just what we do. So not only are we working with the school system, but we're engaging community residents to really find out what do they want to see happen in this space. And job creation is the number one request.
Now, is the Durfee name going to continue on the Community Innovation Center, or will it have an all-new name?
The Community Innovation Center itself, we're hoping that the community is going to come up with a name for that, and we're working through that process now. But when it comes to the name of the campus, Central Campus, DPSCD has not yet chosen how they're going to name the new consolidation of the school. But regardless, this Innovation Center will remain a part of the Central High School campus and in the branding and in the mission of Detroit Public Schools Community District.
And is it going to be good to go come fall?
It's going to be open come this fall, phase one, and then we will complete phase two by the fall of 2018. So at minimum, we're going to cut the ribbon this fall and have it open to kids and the community.
Chris Lambert is the founder and the CEO of Life Remodeled. This Detroit-based nonprofit invests about $5 million in cash, labor, and materials into one Detroit neighborhood every year. The project's determined by the community's needs and vision. Great innovation, and congratulations on this. And you'll have to let us know how everything comes together once that ribbon cutting happens in the fall.
Thank you to you and your listeners who have a passion for Detroit and the great state of Michigan.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still to come, once the Red Wings leave Joe Louis Arena, what is left to honor the Brown Bomber?
This guy was from Alabama, and he moved here, like so many African Americans moved here, and made Detroit his, and Detroit made him theirs, and we have to make sure we don't lose those things.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The brawl in Hockeytown, Fight Night at the Joe, March 26, 1997, the night Red Wing Darren McCarty tore into Colorado's Claude Lemieux.
And we see Igor Larionov go, but he did, and now Darren McCarty gets his shots in at Claude Lemieux. And look who came all the way out to try to help, Patrick Waugh. Oh, my goodness. You never know when to expect it, Darren McCarty said before. Vernon and Waugh. Mike Vernon with a great left. Follows up with the right. How about this? Lemieux was hammered by Darren McCarty, and he is being helped into the locker room.
And the reason for that huge fight, it happened 301 days earlier. Game 6, Western Conference Finals, the Red Wings against the Colorado Avalanche. Claude Lemieux hit wing center Chris Draper from behind, and that sent Draper face first into the bench, smashing his face. Chris Draper retired from the Red Wings in 2011 after winning four Stanley Cups, and these days he's a special assistant to the Wings general manager, and he is with us now. Chris Draper, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and quite the introduction, that's for sure.
I guess I should say happy anniversary, maybe?
Yeah. Listening to that, I mean, you can barely hear the announcer. You know, you just hear the fans, and, you know, with the 20-year anniversary coming up of that night and the closing of the Joe, and I know, you know, a lot of everyone kind of talks about their favorite moments at Joe Louis Arena, and I know a lot of people pick that game and pick that night as one of their favorite moments. And it's amazing 20 years later, you know, I run into people and it's like, you know, I was at that game, you know, and then other people would talk about, you know, where they were when the game happened. It's just something that hockey fans don't forget.
No, they don't. And take us to the night of when you were hit, Chris. What do you remember about that hit and the moments after?
To be honest with you, I remember it very vividly. There was a scrum along the boards. Joe Sack was there. Marty Lapointe was there. The puck kind of squirted out. I was right by our bench. I pulled it out, and then I got it. I moved the puck. The next thing I remember is being on all fours. Obviously, got blindsided, got hit hard. I was down, and I just remember our trainer, John Wharton, was there immediately because it was right in front of our bench. You know, I had been hit before. I had stitches. I had been concussed, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I was just kind of on all fours, and I was like, you know, this one just felt different. Tried to get up right away, and that didn't work out too well. And then I was on all fours, and then John Wharton and Keith came on the ice to help me up. And I just remember I could see the door to get off the ice. And I was just like, just get to the door. And that was really, I remember just getting there. And I took one step off the ice, and next thing I know, I woke up, and I was in the dressing room with the doctors. I woke up twice and blacked out a couple more times. And obviously, I, you know, been loaded with some painkillers and sat up, and just like I had done before and just like hockey players do, you get off the table and you start getting dressed, and I was ready to go back out there. And that's when the doc kind of grabbed me and said, we got to have a little talk here. And he walked me over to the mirror and said, you're definitely done for the night.
Whoa. Well, I guess so. Broken orbital bone, broken cheekbone, broken nose, broken jaw, concussion.
Yeah. I had, I think it was 16 to 18 stitches, a laceration right under my eye where I broke my orbital.
And there was a long recovery, but then take us to March 26, 1997. Your jaws are unwired, you're back on the ice, and it was the brawl. And this was the third time the Wings and Avs had played each other since that infamous Game 6. What do you think was different about this game?
Actually, that was the fourth dime. That was our fourth and final meeting before the playoffs. Lemieux was hurt. He didn't play in any of the three previous games. So that was probably obviously the biggest thing. It was in our rink. You know, we hadn't beat them up until this game. At the time, the game was not going our way at all. They were beating us physically. They were beating us on the scoreboard. They were the defending Stanley Cup champions, and they were playing like it. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, there's a scrum along the boards right bench side by us. You know, it was Igor Larionov and Peter Forsberg. Then a kind of little bit of a delay. There's a little scrum kind of going on. And then, you know, Max wires crossed, and he searched out Lemieux. And then, you know, just like you just started with that clip of the interview, away it went.
Away it went, and it did.
You know, in the article for Players Tribune, you know, just the one time I was watching the video, I was almost frozen just watching it. And I've watched this probably hundreds of times. It's something that you just don't forget. You know, we probably couldn't have scripted it any better. The brawl, the way the fights went, the way we kind of rallied around each other, and then we ended up having a comeback. We were in overtime, and ironically enough, Darren McCarty comes out and he scores the game-winning goal. So for our team, that was just something. When teams go on and be successful and during a season, there's probably, you know, all teams can kind of say, you know what, this game kind of stood out. And just that game of how everything happened with the brawl, with the way the score was, we were down by 3 goals at one point. We came back to win. Max scores in overtime. That was a big statement for our team that we were ready to go. And obviously then 97 turns out to be us being Stanley Cup champs and, you know, ending the 42-year-long drought. And, you know, so we couldn't have scripted that game any better for our team.
You sure couldn't. Darren McCarty told me Lemieux once skated over to him years later during a game and said to McCarty, "Hey, I hear things are going better for you. I'm glad for you." I'm wondering, did you ever hear anything from Claude Lemieux?
No, he didn't. And I'm fine with it. You know, like, that's the one thing. I know, you know, he and Mac, obviously, that's something that, you know, was epic for the game of hockey. That rivalry between, you know, 1996 to 2002 was unreal for the game. I'm glad that he said that because, obviously, you know, Mac, he has had some tough times, and Mac is an all-world teammate, an all-world friend, and it's nice that, you know, he did reach out to see how Mac was doing. But, you know, for me, we never crossed paths like that. Never did until, you know, like I said in my article, until the day after the draft a couple years ago. That was really the first time that we had any conversation whatsoever.
This is a real moment in history for the Red Wings as the doors are getting ready to close forever on Joe Louis Arena, going to get torn down. What do you take away as your top memories from your years at Joe Louis Arena?
Well, so fortunate to have so many. It's unreal. You know, for me, you know, winning the Stanley Cup in 1997, just with everything that we had just talked about, mm-hmm. you know, in 96, that was a devastating loss for our team. And obviously, personally, for me, even more so. We had set the record with NHL regular season wins. We were the hands-on favorite to win the Stanley Cup. You know, and obviously, it came up short. We lost 6 games to Colorado. You go back, you know, the previous 2 years, we got swept by New Jersey in the finals in 95. And then we got upset by San Jose Sharks in 94 in the first round. We were a team that just kind of seemed like we were always there, but, you know, people kind of questioned if we had enough to win the Stanley Cup. And for us, being able to silence all the critics and kind of keep that core team together and become Stanley Cup champions in 1997, that's something that I'll never forget. You know, the first time that I grabbed the Stanley Cup, you're able to do that victory lap with it on Joe Louis Arena in front of 20,000 fans, confetti raining down. I had my, you know, my whole family there. My wife, who at the time was my girlfriend, she was there. Just amazing moments like that. But you just look at the teams that I was able to play for and the success that I was able to have with so many of those guys. We have so many memories, and it's such a special place. For me, one of my greatest moments in Joe Louis Arena was Game 2 in 1998, the Stanley Cup Finals. In overtime, I scored the game-winning goal against Washington Capitals at Joe Louis Arena. I mean, that's something, you know, I'll never, ever forget. And then, you know, we won again in 02 against Carolina at home. So many great things, so many great games. It's a place that I've walked into thousands of times. It's obviously an older building, but it's an intimate building. And you just see the same people and the friendly people. And that, to me, is something that, you know, is so special for being a Detroit Red Wing.
Chris Draper, we want to thank you so much for sharing your memories and also thank you for all those years on the ice with the Detroit Red Wings.
That was my pleasure. I'll tell you what, on behalf of my teammates, we had, you know, an amazing run. And Joe Louis Arena and the fans, I mean, can't say enough, you know, of how they kept coming out, 20,000 game in, game out, night after night. And, you know, we were fortunate to share four Stanley Cups with all Detroit Red Wing fans at Joe Louis Arena and you know, the city of Detroit, the parades. I mean, you name it. It was an amazing run for our team in that era, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
And the clock is indeed ticking on Joe Louis Arena. The Red Wings' final season at the Joe is down to just a handful of games, and next season will find them on the ice in the $600 million Little Caesars Arena. Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley has a question. What will Detroit then do to honor the memory of Joe Louis? Rochelle, why is it so important to keep that name of Joe Louis front and center in Detroit?
Well, I've been on this campaign for several years now to make black history not just black history. You know, we're one America.
Something that happens in February.
Exactly. We're one America, one history, and there's all these amazing things that people should know. The Joe Louis-Max Schmeling fight wasn't just a fight. It was like this epic battle for the idea of freedom. You know, this this was something that almost every black American with a radio was listening to, because it was like, this is an affirmation for us. All of these Americans, we have to beat the German. You know, we. Anything that provides a sense of unity, and Joe Louis represented that, I don't want that to be lost. You know, there are so few people that are honored that way in the state of Michigan. And it's not great everywhere, but there are other states that do a little better job with their history. You know, we want our kids and our grandkids and our great-great-great-grandkids to know Rosa Parks and to know Joe Louis and to know why they should know those things. So for me, it was one of the first things I thought about. I'm not a hockey fan, as I've told you. Yeah. Like the skating back and forth, don't like the fighting and the scoring. But I said, they're going to tear down that building. What's going to happen to his name?
Because basically there's the statue as you go into the Cobo Convention Center, and then there's the fist. And that thing really has divided people.
I had this conversation with Mayor Mike Duggan, who, by the way, has pledged, has declared that we will do something to honor Joe Louis when that's torn down, and something in a big way. And there are things. The fist, you know, it's supposed to represent Joe Louis, but that's not something you know from looking at that fist. I hate that fist. That fist represents a lot of things that the artist didn't intend. So I am a huge fan of art and artistic expression, and whatever it says they mean, that's what it means. But I don't know any kid who's going to look over at that and understand the story of Joe Louis and Max Schmeling.
And understand the ties that Joe Louis has to Southeast Michigan, to Detroit in particular.
Absolutely.
There's, I mean, just give us a sense of what we may have forgotten beyond the Max Schmeling fight.
Well, here's the thing. Joe Louis was iconic. I mean, not only was he remains the longest reigning boxing champion in history. Until somebody surpasses his record, he still has that. But he also played golf, and he helped to integrate the PGA because they wanted him to play the celebrity tournament. And they said, well, you know, it's for pros, and he's an amateur. He's a boxer, not a golfer. And they said, well, let him do it anyway, do an exception. Then they said, oh, but by the way, he's black. And they fought, and they won. And that led to the integration of the Tiger Woods, you know, I mean, literally. And also, there was just this great sense of what it meant to be a champion. This is a city of champions. And if we don't honor their names, we'll forget their names. This guy was from Alabama, and he moved here, like so many African Americans moved here, and made Detroit his. And Detroit made him theirs, and we have to make sure we don't lose those things.
Well, you kind of fired an opening salvo with an initial column, and you asked people for ideas. So what are some of the ideas that jump out at you that poured in?
Oh, my God. Well, first of all, I want to thank if any of your listeners, and since you have so many, I know some of you are some who sent in ideas. Thank you, because it let me know that I wasn't the only one feeling that way. The ideas were as varied as the people sending them in. For instance, one of my favorites was the guy who wanted to take the statue that exists inside Cobo, that if you don't go to Cobo for things, you don't see it, and move it out to the riverfront and have Joe Louis overlooking the river in a peace garden. Boxing is such a violent sport, you know, peace garden with his story, someplace where you walk out there and you can actually read about what happened. And another one was this amazing older guy who listened to fights on the radio, wanted to have a museum of champions and have a big wing for Joe Louis, but have some of these other people who mean so much to our history, to Detroit history, but who would be lost if we don't do it.
That would cost money.
That's big money.
The Peace Garden and moving that statue could be done pretty economically.
We could do that next week. There's green space.
Yeah, there is. And didn't somebody suggest perhaps changing the name of Hart Plaza?
Yes, and I like that one, too. They said put a statue. They didn't suggest moving the one in Cobo because they don't mind having two. They said put a giant statue of Joe Louis right at Hart Plaza and rename that Joe Louis Plaza.
And you say you have talked to Mayor Duggan?
I talked to Mayor Duggan. Well, anytime somebody says, let's do something, number one is I start looking at what it costs. Because, for instance, there's one group that oversees golfing at Palmer Park. They take kids there to learn how to play. And because of his ties to golfing, they want to take that and make it the Joe Louis Golf Course at Palmer Park. There's nothing wrong with that, except I had the same concern that I had about the hockey arena. Joe Louis wasn't really a golfer. He just did that. And he wasn't a hockey player, which was great to have that downtown thing.
Right.
And, you know, and they did more than play hockey at Joe Louis. But,
yeah.
You know, the Joe was hockey.
Mm-hmm.
I want him to have his own thing. So the things that will honor him as Joe Louis sort of rose to the top of the list for me. But I didn't, you know, stick my stamp on him. The mayor just said, as you get these ideas, hold on to all of them and give them to me. We want to study every one of them. That meant the world because that means, number one, he's serious. And he said, we are going to do something. Because, you know, that arena, we lost it in I should not say we lost it in bankruptcy. It went to a creditor.
Right.
They will have a certain period of time to turn it into something. And if they don't, it reverts back to the city. Now, we're not going to keep Joe Louis Arena. The mayor already said it's going to become something. It'll probably be residences. And I don't want it to be the Joe Louis home for people who are funky. but I think that if that's what's happening there, there ought to be something just as big as Joe Louis Arena was to continue to honor that name and that history.
So he's got his eye on it, and you've got your eye on him.
Exactly.
To follow up on that. I was intrigued in your follow-up column you mentioned, or story you mentioned, you heard from Joe Louis's son-in-law.
One of the best letters I ever got. And so as I was reading it, I'm like, oh, well, this is a nice guy. And oh, wait a minute.
George Joseph. Right?
This is not just, you know, another idea or another guy. He's married to Joe Louis's daughter. They have met with folks, you know, with the Illich organization, Illich Holdings and Olympia, because they were talking about trying to maintain some sense of Joe Louis in the hockey arena. But that continues the hockey theme.
Yeah.
But he made some really important points. He said Joe Louis is the only athlete in America who has an arena named for him. There's no Jack Dempsey Arena. There's no Muhammad Ali Arena. There's no Michael Jordan Arena. Mm-hmm. And Michael Jordan could have an arena. But there is a Joe Louis Arena. And he said that he wants to make sure that the significance of Joe Louis remains for an entire generation of parents, grandparents, and downtrodden of those. There's no one in today's sports who would inspire the hope and dignity that Detroit's Brown Bomber did for so many outside of Detroit. So George Joseph, he also gave me the funniest line for the column. He said he's been with his wife for 37 years and his official fight record at home is 0-37.
Well, I'm sure getting that imprimatur was from the family was terrific, but so was the response from the public. So you know this is something that is bubbling. It isn't there yet, so the soup isn't cooked yet, but it's bubbling.
I will be following this until that name or that face or that statue or that iconic stance is somewhere where kids will learn who he is, not just that he was a boxer, but what he meant to history and what he meant to Detroit.
Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, and Lise Mesmer. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.